I'm going to say that once more because it sounded like I said I'm Morin good.
Morin good.
That's some Morin. 3, 2, 1. Hi, I'm Lauren Good.
And I'm Gideon Litchfield. And this is Have a Nice Future, a podcast about how terrifyingly fast everything is changing.
Each week, we talk to someone with big, audacious, and sometimes unnerving ideas about the future, and we ask them how we can all prepare to live in it.
Our guest this week is Michael Casey, the chief content officer of CoinDesk, the cryptocurrency news site that almost exactly 1 year ago brought down Sam Bankman-Fried's multi-billion dollar crypto empire.
What I find extremely frustrating is that the debate is about, look how many bad people there are over here. We need to just shut this industry down, as opposed to thinking hard and intelligently about the technology itself and how we might actually create a safer system so that those bad people don't take charge of it.
All right, Gideon, I'm going to ask the question that's on a lot of people's minds. Is crypto dead?
Dead as in, like, nobody using it anymore?
Well, I mean, obviously people are still using it. But as you mentioned, I think the meltdown of FTX was a real wake-up call for crypto believers. It was so hyped up and it ended up losing customers billions of dollars. You know, SBF was the poster boy of crypto and now he's on trial for fraud, which we are covering at Wired. And I feel like pretty much every crypto story I've read since then has been about other crypto companies or exchanges struggling because of the ripple effects of that collapse.
Right. And everyone's talking about crypto winter for, I don't know, like the fourth or fifth time. And yet, as SBF's trial was starting, the price of Bitcoin was up something like 30% on what it was right before FTX collapsed. So a lot of people still believe in crypto.
Which still doesn't make sense to me at all.
It didn't to me either. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to Michael Casey.
Did you know that I used to work with Michael Casey at Dow Jones?
I did not.
Yeah, I used to bug him to join me on a live streaming video show that I was doing at the Wall Street Journal. I had no idea he was a crypto guy or became one.
Yes, he absolutely still thinks crypto is the future of financial systems. And he's in this interesting, unique position because CoinDesk is a media company whose very purpose hinges on the existence of crypto and indeed the success of crypto as a technology. But it also did the reporting that took down SBF and caused all this turmoil that we've seen in the industry.
Yeah, they actually won a big award for that recently. Did you happen to see that?
Oh, I actually didn't.
They won a Loeb, which is one of the most prestigious awards in business journalism. So kudos to them. Yeah. But I also saw that CoinDesk was put up for sale. Was yes. that in any way related to the FTX collapse?
Well, indeed it was. And that's another part of what makes their situation so interesting. So CoinDesk's parent company, DCG, owns a bunch of crypto companies and assets. And the fallout of FTX forced it to put a lot of those assets up for sale, including CoinDesk itself. So Michael's challenge now is how to make CoinDesk a thriving business during this latest crypto winter.
So you're saying the future of journalism is not to put all of your assets in crypto?
Well, maybe the future of crypto journalism is not to put all your assets in crypto. That's for sure.
Okay, fair enough.
Anyway, I wanted to talk to Michael both to have him explain how he still believes in crypto after everything that's happened, but also to understand how a news organization that's covering this industry walks the line between being an advocate for it and also a critic of it.
Well, I'm so curious to hear what he has to say.
And that conversation is coming up right after the break. Michael Casey, welcome to Have a Nice Future.
Thank you for having me, Gideon.
Are you having a nice future?
Ask me tomorrow. I don't know.
Ask you in the future.
In the future.
Okay. Well, we're speaking because it's coming up to a year after one of the world's biggest cryptocurrency exchanges, FTX, went bankrupt and billions of dollars worth of its customers' money went missing. And we're here basically to talk about how the crypto world looks a year after that and how it will look in the future. But I want to start with you. Mm-hmm. How did you start covering crypto? What made you interested in it and what made you believe in it?
Yeah, so I was at the Wall Street Journal at the time and I had covered currencies. I saw this strange thing called Bitcoin. Everyone was talking about this. Is in 2013. I was writing a column at the time called Horizons for the Wall Street Journal, and I wrote some pretty basic, hey, don't touch this thing, it's probably a tulip bubble kind of story. And then I got called in by a few people, who, some of whom are still in the industry, some who aren't, some prominent names, some of them big venture capitalists, and others taken out for dinner, explained what it was all about. And I think because of the fact that I'd spent 6 years of my life in Argentina, it's a country that just has perpetual crises. It's just never resolved its monetary problems throughout a very long 100-year history of ups and downs. And suddenly this alternative to how a monetary system could run was presented in front of me, something that didn't need a government. And it's just dawned on me as just a phenomenal idea.
Right. So you saw crypto as a kind of an answer to the brokenness of it. Existing financial systems.
And also just a different, just fascinating that you could construct it without an institution in the middle of it. This idea that money didn't have to be issued by a government. That was just a revelation that just became a never-ending quest to explore.
So you wound up as chief content officer at CoinDesk, which famously published the story last November that brought down FTX. And we'll talk more about that in a second, but maybe just for our listeners who don't know, describe really briefly what CoinDesk is.
We describe ourselves as the leading media events and indices company in the crypto and digital asset space.
Right. And so, like a lot of media companies that cover a particular industry, you have this sort of joint role of being a watchdog for it and also to an extent a cheerleader. You are interested in growing and promoting the existence of the industry itself and making it better. Does that seem fair? And
I think so. I always flinch a little bit. And I think you, as a journalist, would do is the word cheerleader. Like, it's just not something we ever want to describe ourselves as. I think that it's pretty hard to be in crypto journalism if you don't have some belief in the power of the technology. That's obviously quite different from cheerleading any particular company or even cheerleading the industry as it currently is, right? Like, the two things are different.
Right. The thing that I think is interesting is any industry media publication has to strike this balance, but it's an especially delicate balance in an industry like crypto where there are so many scams and grifts. So what are your guiding principles for being honest about what is going on in the industry whilst also fundamentally believing that it's a worthwhile industry?
So many scams. I mean, there are a lot, without a doubt. Like, I think it would be naive to say that there are not a lot of scams. It is obviously something that we are constantly reporting on. You just have to look at CoinDesk coverage. Mm-hmm. If you truly believe, as I do, for example, that we have a fundamentally broken internet with, you know, Google, Facebook, and these massive platforms controlling our data and manipulating us via that. And you'd love to see a system that no longer had that dependency and people had control of their data. Then, you know, you're going to cover this industry for the sake of holding it to account so that it does improve.
So speaking of that, speaking of holding an industry to account, let's go back to the day, November 2nd, when CoinDesk published this report on problems at FTX. Maybe just begin by very briefly describing what those problems were for anyone who doesn't remember.
Okay, so the first company that now a name that everybody would be familiar with, Sam Bankman-Fried, had created before he created the exchange FTX, was called Alameda Research. Alameda was a trading firm, and there was always known that there was a relationship between the two companies, but we didn't really have any idea about how deeply intertwined they were until our reporter, Ian Allison, got hold of a balance sheet. This is a private company. The balance sheet was not formally released, and this was Alameda's balance sheet, and it showed that a lot of the assets that it recognized on its books were actually FTT, a token that was issued by FTX. What that showed was this very circular relationship, that the assets that this company held were actually completely defined by the institution on which it depended for a lot of business, and essentially it exposed a house of cards. And, right, you know, front-running, you know, misuse of customer funds and an absolutely enormous number of breaches of the fiduciary duty that, you know, any exchange has to its users.
Do you think that you could have predicted when FTX first collapsed that it would have so many ripple effects in this way, such a domino effect.
We could have. I don't think we did. I'm not sure many people did. There were certainly people that were looking at the prevalence. And let's remember that these problems existed in traditional finance as well, right? The intertwined structure of Wall Street was a defining feature of the financial crisis of 2008. But I don't think anyone really was out there just predicting how dramatically affected everybody would be.
So overall, how would you say the crypto world looks today in the wake of all of that?
So there's been two phases of what people in this industry describe as the crypto winter. The first is this massive unwind, a load of bankruptcies. And what we've seen in each of these winters, a departure of interest in the sector from the kind of retail enthusiasts who were the fly-by-night folks who would come in and out, not sort of long-term investors, but just had gotten excited at the top of the market. And as always, when these things happen, they're the ones who lose their shirts when it comes down. Those people had disappeared. There was no more. The search queries on Google for crypto, for example, have just plummeted. What's different about this time is that it has also come with a very aggressive set of enforcement actions by the U.S. regulatory apparatus, most notably by the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. It's my belief, others might say otherwise, that the extraordinarily large extent to which my former colleague at MIT, Gary Gensler, has gone to really attack a lot of firms here.
This is Gary Gensler, the SEC chairman.
That's right, the chairman of the SEC. It feels very motivated by payback, right? Like a very large number of lawmakers who had received donations from Sam Bankman-Fried and from FTX. He'd spread his largesse across both sides of the house, and then it turned out that he was just a crook on the masses.
Far worse,
because it is this idea that you have breached everybody's trust. You know, you don't go into Washington and, you know, make this sort of a mess without expecting some payback. And it's conceived as a payback against all of crypto, which is pretty unfair, I would say.
Well, I'm going to challenge you on that in a bit because I want to talk about what the SEC is actually doing. So in June, it sued Binance and Coinbase, which are two of the world's biggest crypto exchanges. A large part of its lawsuit against both exchanges is that it thinks most crypto assets should be regulated like securities, like stocks and bonds, for example. But then there's a second issue, and that's where it's really suing, where the SEC is suing Binance, which is a bunch of violations for mismanaging its customers' funds, which are not unsimilar to some of the charges that were leveled against FTX. So let's take these two things in.
Or MF Global or HSBC or Standard Chartered, right, or any single bank that has been in this. I mean, I'm not trying to forgive them, but like those things happen throughout finance because finance is full of crooks. It always has, always will be. I've been covering it for 20 years, and trust me, there are a lot. You could look through a Wikipedia page on something like this. But anyway, carry on.
All right. Well, let's go back to these two separate issues as they relate to crypto. So let's start with the regulatory question. Should most crypto assets be regulated like securities, as the SEC is claiming? What's your position on that?
If you just treat every token as a security, it ceases to be able to function for what it does. And so if you created a system that was purely securities, then anybody owning one, anybody who wants to participate, this is supposed to be an open system. It's supposed to solve things like financial inclusion so that people in the developing world can gain access to payment systems and so forth. Every one of those people would have to be an accredited investor. It doesn't make any sense, right? You can't run a decentralized system with that level of bureaucracy in the middle of it.
Okay, so it sounds like you're basically saying that regulating crypto assets as securities would limit far too much the ability of people to participate in the system and to use it to solve the kinds of financial problems that you think cryptocurrencies can solve.
I'm not at all saying that this shouldn't be regulated. I'm saying that we need a smart way of trying to deal with this.
So I think part of the reason that the SEC is trying to enforce these assets as securities is that, you know, regardless of what you say should ideally be happening, people are treating them a speculative investments, like Ethereum, I think, is up 20% mm-hmm. for the year. Is there a way to square the circle? Is there a way to have it not become just a speculative asset?
It's called consumer finance. It's called It's called, like, there's a whole lot of laws for how, like, you know, what Sam Bankman-Fried did was you know, allegedly illegal. Let's see how the case that started now plays out. I think many people are pretty convinced that it was. And so there's laws that don't require necessarily securities laws to do so. Like, there's a breach of a whole host of consumer finance and fiduciary duties. There is all sorts of ways to stop people from doing bad things. Like, the risk that an investor faces, which is what you are trying to, you know, protect against, it comes down to who controls it. Is there a system in which some company, some entity, some person controls your assets? And under a pure decentralized crypto system, you control the assets, not Sam Bankman-Fried. And so there's a lot out there that would make this a safer system, but it's really not being contemplated by the current administration.
You said just now that what Sam Bankman-Fried did was allegedly illegal. Is there a world in which it wasn't illegal?
I think we all. I'm trying to be a good journalist here, Gideon. I'm just trying to,
just
like, you know, innocent before proven guilty. Yes, but I think
fair enough.
That's
all right.
It.
So let's go back to something else that you said, because I started talking about how the SEC is also suing Binance over allegedly misusing its customers' funds or mismanaging them, and how that was similar to what FTX did. And you jumped in and said, well, also a whole bunch of banks, also large parts of the traditional
financial system.
Which
sounds like whataboutism maybe, yeah?
It sounds a bit like whataboutism, but I think more interestingly than that, my question is this. Some of the promise, I think, well, the promise of crypto was that it was going to be decentralized, was that it wasn't going to be captured by institutions or by individuals. And yet that is de facto what has happened. Because it turns out that even when you run a decentralized system, you need some things like exchanges, or you need trading spaces for NFTs, for example. And those end up being dominated by, on the whole, a handful of parties. So I feel like the problem of corruption or mismanagement that we've seen in the crypto industry is to a large extent for that reason. In other words, it doesn't seem like it is actually immune from the same kind of challenges that face the financial system. So how would you get past that?
Well, I think that's a fair criticism. And I think that that's on crypto, right? That's on this industry for defaulting to the simple solutions.
Is it on crypto or is it just on human beings?
I think it's on human beings as well. I think actually it's very difficult to build a decentralized system. They are inherently complicated, and it's very, very difficult to do it by snapping your fingers. But Bitcoin achieved it, right? There is nobody in charge of Bitcoin, and it runs this way.
But there are
day
people
day
in charge of the exchanges where Bitcoin is
sure,
traded. I think that's
sure.
my point.
No, it is. And
it
we can
ends
get,
up centralizing
and,
somewhere.
But there are decentralized exchanges, Gideon. There are, and they function, some of them. Uniswap, for example, has really never had any problems. It works. It's very complicated for the average person to use. So it's still on crypto. Crypto needs to develop better UX, easier systems, et cetera, et cetera. The point I'm just simply making is that it's possible to build these things. And if there were the right framework within which to do so, I think innovation would go in that direction.
Can you give maybe just one example of a piece of regulation that you think would help make crypto safer?
There are laws around the separation of trading operations and investment, a variety of things that are just the norm for now for exchanges in the TradFi world should be applied in crypto. And that would just be one very effective way to, I think, you know, protect investors and consumers from malfeasance.
Has the past year changed your own thinking about the future of the crypto industry in any way?
It's made it apparent that we have to figure this out as a political process. There has to be public debate about it. There has to be engagement with politicians. We've got to figure out a regulatory transition somewhere that enables this in the right way. So I think there's a...
What do you think makes that difficult?
Oh, it's lack of education. I think it is characters like Sam Bankman-Fried who have just shed such a negative light on this industry. So what I find extremely frustrating is that the debate is about, look how many bad people there are over here. We need to just shut this industry down, as opposed to thinking hard and intelligently about the technology itself and how we might actually, you know, create a safer system so that those bad people don't take charge of it. I don't know. It's frustrating.
To me, who's always been something of a crypto skeptic, I think the past year has just reinforced my sense that
I'm sure it has.
It's going to be confined to a fairly niche group of users because, as you say, there are problems with making it usable and accessible, and then difficulties in explaining to people how to regulate it or how to have a sensible conversation about regulation. And it still seems to be beset by volatility and by risk and by
Bitcoin's risk of insider dealing. Bitcoin's been one of the most stable assets around for the last month, by the way. But right. No, you're so right. In general, you're right. Yes.
You're obviously still a big believer.
I'm a believer in the underlying technology. I'm a believer in the underlying technology. I believe that I literally believe we have no choice but to create a decentralized system. And well, because Google, the monopolization of our lives. It's the idea that our data is controlled by these algorithms. And we're moving into an AI world in which these centralized entities, profit motively driven to literally manipulate us with that data, are now going to get even more powerful. So that is what's at stake here. We can just talk about Sam Bankman-Fried and like whether or not we need a fancy way to play, you know, some sort of insurance scam. It's really about how is the digital economy going to function going forward? We need this thing to be fixed, I'm telling you.
All right, let's talk about the future, since this is called Have a Nice Future. What do you think crypto looks like in, I don't know, 10 to 15 years from now?
I think it's going to be normalized through the financial system. I'm not sure that that's great, by the way. I think you're going to have a lot of traditional finance actors. If, you know, we have BlackRock, Fidelity, Franklin Templeton, VanEck, all these sort of big institutions, very, very far down the path of developing their own digital asset strategies. They are looking to have ETFs and the like regulated. And I think they're going to be the big players in this space.
And that's bad. Why?
It's bad if it normalizes the idea that the only way to actually participate in this is through a old 1933 Securities Act, which means that if you're wanting to own or trade Bitcoin and you are not an accredited investor or you're not a big institution, then the only way to own it is through some ETF that is controlled by so-and-so. You can't, that idea of monetary freedom that it represents is not possible if this has to be heavily, heavily regulated.
But you're not against regulation. It sounds like the old institutions getting their fingers in it.
Yes. And what I'm trying to say is like by the institutions coming along and validating it, they're all regulated, right? They're essentially endorsing this system. The general public is just not going to think about it. They're all going to buy their ETFs and so forth. It's not going to be the same sort of decentralized system. But look, I don't think that's the end of the world because I've never been a believer that the most valuable thing was everybody owning Bitcoin. That's going to sound like heresy to a lot of Bitcoin maxis, but I don't think that's it, right? I actually do think that creating decentralized mechanisms for things like data, I go back to the internet. I think those are the most important things. And so what I'm actually most encouraged by, what I would like to think is going to be the most interesting thing happening in the next 10 years, is that self-sovereign identity solutions are going to become the norm.
So CoinDesk's parent company, DCG, also obviously suffered some fallout from the FTX collapse. And in July, it was announced that CoinDesk is being sold to outside investors. Does that change anything for CoinDesk?
Oh, inevitably. A change of ownership does. It's a new phase. I think DCG has had a very, very tough last year and a half. And it's difficult when your parent company is going through that. We have a whole host of things that we want to do. We still believe there's huge growth opportunities. The deal as it's structured would have a wider variety of investors as part of a consortium. And that's, I think, a constructive structure for a news organization that is striving to be independent.
Other than the future of CoinDesk, what keeps you up at night?
I think we could very well go rapidly into a dystopian world in which humanity is reduced to a bit player in a system run by machines, and that the worst of human instincts will now be adopted by machines, which will basically carry out the work. That's the dystopian path, right? Yeah, if we get it right and really focus on taking power away from the centralized entities that control these massive data-driven models and figure out how there's a collective ownership in that, then of course AI could just be a wonderful driver of a bright future, a better future that your podcast is looking for everyone to have.
And so the flip side of that is, what keeps you optimistic?
I'm going to sound a little hokey, but I actually think that at their core, human beings want to do well by each other. And we need systems that enhance that, that encourage that, that actually are built to protect against the worst instincts that we have and encourage the best ones.
And it sounds like you think that crypto could be one of those systems.
Crypto could be part of it. I'm not the naive, it fixes everything. There's a blockchain for that solution kind of guy. I believe in government and regulation and all those things, but I think that we need to think hard about where there's a good intersection between existing systems and certain centralized solutions, government, and these decentralized alternatives that brings us to that happier place.
Well, Michael, thank you very much for making the case for believing in crypto, in these systems, despite all of the events of the last year and few years. So thank you for joining us on Have a Nice Future.
Thank you for having me, Gideon.
So do you own any crypto?
I still own no crypto. I do own an NFT of some piece of art that I was given. But no, I've never bought or sold a piece of cryptocurrency. What about you?
Wait, hold on. You own a piece of an NFT or a piece of art that's an NFT?
A piece of art that's an NFT, or rather an NFT of a piece of art. You know what? I haven't even looked at it in a while. I don't remember. It was a freebie. It was a freebie at some event about NFTs. You know how these things go.
Wow. Have you checked the value of it lately?
I'm not even sure it has a value.
Okay. I wrote a story last year for Wired about a Steph Curry NFT that I had been, I guess, gifted. It was on loan to me. And I think at the time that I acquired it, which is February of 2022, and by the time I wrote about it, which was the spring or maybe summer of 2022, it had declined in value from like $1,000 to $6.
Wow. Okay. I mean, yeah. I feel like we're just exposing our Luddite tendencies here by talking about how we don't own any crypto. And it, you know, it used to be this thing that journalists shouldn't own cryptocurrency because it was like having a conflict of interest. I think definitely we should be past that by now. Certainly, if you're going to write about cryptocurrency, I think it makes sense to at least own a token amount of it so you understand how it works.
Well, that's good that I own some then.
Yes, indeed, it is. You have more authority than I do.
I'm looking at my Robinhood app right now. And according to this, on the day of taping, I am $15.27 in the hole on my sliver of a Bitcoin. So I'm doing really well here. I mean,
when did you buy this sliver of a Bitcoin?
Let's see if I can tap on it and see my history. Well, I'm checking my positions right now. It's actually up 43% over the past year, according to this. Why am I down? I don't know. I don't understand it.
Just wait long enough and you'll be up again. That is the nature of these things.
I can tell you that even if we emerge from this trough, this crypto winter, and this surges, I'm still not going to be able to retire.
So you're saying you're not giving up the day job?
No, not giving up the day job. And I would say that I'm still a crypto skeptic like you. And I'm wondering, did your conversation with Michael Casey make you any less skeptical?
I don't think it did. I mean, I think the argument that I was having back and forth with Michael at some level was about whether the potential for cryptocurrency to be a well-regulated, well-run, largely fraud-free industry depended on the technology itself, on the ability of the technology to provide decentralized systems, or whether it is really entirely dependent on the human beings and human beings' tendency to find graft opportunities wherever they can. And so Michael was saying to me, look, the traditional financial industry is full of fraud as well, and the crypto industry has a chance to be better because it has this decentralized technology.
I guess I'm still wondering whether or not you're convinced.
You know, I want to not be quite as skeptical as I am, and maybe I should just buy some crypto and get into it so that I can ease my skepticism that way. For me, the thing that is fundamental here is when you look at the crypto industry, the promise of crypto was supposed to be the decentralization, that no one person or entity was going to have power over these systems. And as I was saying to Michael, what you've seen emerge again and again is that even when you have decentralized currencies on a blockchain, you still need some centralized entity somewhere along the line for it to work. You need an exchange where cryptocurrency is turned into conventional currency. You need a marketplace where NFTs are bought and sold. You need some system for, let's say, blockchains have been used for land registries, for example, but somebody needs to authenticate that you actually own that land before you can put it on a blockchain. So no matter where you are in the system, there is an opportunity for humans to insert themselves, for power to be centralized, and for fraud to happen. And I'm just not convinced that that can ever be overcome. But Michael was arguing if we only regulate things well enough, and if the crypto industry itself somehow gets its act together, despite having been so fraud-ridden up to now, then maybe things can get better.
He seemed to be implying that the SEC's efforts to regulate crypto are inspired by vengeance rather than motivated by a real desire to protect investors. Do you agree with that?
Not really. I mean, he was saying that lots and lots of lawmakers took money from Sam Bankman-Fried, mm-hmm. which is true. He was, spreading his largesse left and right, and that therefore the SEC's enforcement against the industry was kind of payback for that. But I don't think that's true at all. I think, the effort to regulate cryptocurrencies as securities dates back long before most people had heard of Sam Bankman-Fried. And it is this debate that's been running for a while about whether these assets that can be much more than just a currency, like in the case of Ethereum, it's essentially the basis for an entire programming language, whether those should be regulated like securities that people trade in other ways, or whether they should be dealt with as some kind of new thing. And I agree, I suppose, with Michael that we need to not try to apply 100-year-old securities laws to these entirely new instruments. We ought to come up with something better. But on the other hand, I think that trying to protect investors from these very, very volatile markets is a sensible instinct. And much as people like Michael Casey would like cryptocurrencies to be treated as more than just a speculative investment, the fact is that they are being treated as a speculative investment. And that is what the SEC is trying to protect people from.
Mm-hmm. So Michael also talked about the quote-unquote monopolization of our lives. He said, we're moving into an AI world in which these centralized entities, and he was talking about companies like Google and Meta, are driven to manipulate us with that data, our data, and are going to get even more powerful. That really resonated with me. But how do you think he meant crypto is supposed to solve that?
I can't say that I understand this argument very well, but it's one I've encountered in the past, which is, if we own our data, if we have access to or control data about us or data about our customers, for example, or our followers on social media, if we have that data and we control it and it's on a blockchain rather than being held by a centralized company like Google or Facebook, if we have that control, then we have power over that data. Then we can decide what happens to it. We can find ways to make money off of it. We can decide who to transfer it to, but it's never going to be in the hands of a company that can take it away from us. How exactly that's supposed to work is the stuff that I don't understand very well, but that's the kind of the principle that a lot of crypto and blockchain enthusiasts talk about.
So what's actually a better solution here? Introducing a decentralized but potentially befuddling new form of internet, or regulating the monopolies as they currently exist?
So I think that is the key question. Michael and I actually got into a discussion on this that was too long to include in the podcast. But a few weeks ago, you interviewed Cory Doctorow here on the show. And Cory's belief, like Michael's, is that we need to strip away the power of these gigantic tech companies that control all our data. But they come at it from very, very different ways of how to do it. And so Michael is saying, if we use blockchains and cryptocurrency, we can give people ownership of their data in such a way that it's decentralized, no single entity controls it, and then that gives people the power. Cory takes a rather different view, and he says what we need is interoperability. We need to force the big tech companies to let us move our data back and forth between them. To, if we decide we want to take our contacts or our social media graph or all our photos and videos and whatever off of Meta and put them onto some other company's platform, we should be able to do that. And if regulation forces the tech companies to let us do that, that will put power back in the hands of the people.
How to build a better internet. That's what it is. That's what sort of what we're getting at. In fact, we should probably just rebrand the show that.
Yeah, how to build a better internet. But if you're asking me which of those approaches I believe in more, I suppose I probably lean more towards interoperability. I feel like it's going to be easier to introduce regulation that forces companies to let their users move their data around than it is to build an entire new system for data management and ownership based on blockchains and make that system easy to use and understandable to everybody, because right now it's really confusing. But of course, Michael would disagree with me on that.
So what do you think that means for the future of the blockchain then? I mean, does it mean that 10 years from now, we're still talking about it as something that like the folks over at Andreessen Horowitz are using and maybe a few outliers around the world and like we're still just battling for a better internet based on the infrastructure we currently have?
I actually think that despite my skepticism, I'm relatively bullish for the future of the blockchain and crypto because I think so many people are invested in it at this point. So many people are working on different variations of this technology that there is still going to be an industry in 5 or 10 years' time. I have no idea what it's going to be doing. Perhaps I will be proved wrong on a lot of the things I've said about how susceptible it is to fraud and corruption or how difficult it is to use. Maybe those problems will be solved and Michael is right. Most revealing and possibly most realistic is that crypto does have a future, but it's one in which it's basically been co-opted by the existing big tech platforms and by the existing big banks. And they all issue their own ETFs for crypto. And, right. You know, we end up in a similar...
The vanguards of the world and fidelities right. of the world. It's not very sexy.
It's not very sexy, but it's the like the Occam's razor prediction that things will change less than you expect. And so we will end up with crypto, but it will still be run by big banks.
And at that point, I will be retired on my crypto earnings.
I very much hope so for your sake.
My sliver of Bitcoin. Well, that's a very optimistic view of the future.
In that case, let's end on that note.
All right, that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening.
Have a Nice Future is hosted by me, Gideon Litchfield.
And me, Lauren Good. And if you like the show, we would love to hear from you. You can leave us a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe so you can get new episodes each week.
You can also email us your comments at nicefuture@wired.com. Tell us what you're worried about, what excites you, any questions you have about the future, and we'll try our best to answer them with our guests.
Gideon in particular is looking for crypto stock tips. So if you have those,
yes,
please send them to him.
nicefuture@wired.com. Thank you.
You know where it's at. Have a Nice Future is a production of Condé Nast Entertainment. Danielle Hewitt from Prologue Projects produces the show with help from Madeline Kaplan. And our assistant producer is Arlene Arevalo.
We'll be back here next Wednesday. And until then, have a nice future.
Nice future.